Hi, this is Katie Tunstall.
You sound like her, you look like her.
I am her, incredible, the very one.
Incredible. You're Scottish?
I'm Scottish.
See, I had someone who worked for me a long time
ago who was from the north. Picking up on the glottal stop there.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because I can say platinum records, the Brit, tons of awards, and I'll do it in the announcer voice, 58 million plays for me. And probably for you, the best music comes out of real life. And sometimes that's tragedy, sometimes that's pain. But that's life, and you're living that. And this trilogy, that's what it's about.
Well, music's always got, songwriting's always that got that alchemical aspect to it, where you can literally turn a turd into gold. But you can just take the most awful thing, and the most painful thing, the saddest thing that's happened to you, and actually genuinely turn it into something very useful and cathartic. Not only to you, but to other people.
But thank
as well.
Goodness artists can do that, right?
I know. Well, it's and this is the thing. Artists. It's a real vent. It's a real outlet for... And there's something very healing about making something concrete out of pain and creating something. And as a listener and as a fan, it's this pressure valve that if you hear a song, it can just release that pressure for you and describe how you're feeling in a way that it's just very medicinal.
So Kin was, in my mind, it was making it through all the trauma victoriously.
Exactly.
It was about survival and coming out the other side, you know, and the spirit and the soul. So yeah. We know that.
But also coming through, not only surviving, but actually getting to the place where you're glad it happened. I realize, too, that there is a moment in your life when these big things happen to you, and maybe big thing, you know, those big things haven't happened yet. And you're still to experience that. I hadn't really had anything major go down before these two events in my life. And you have to make a decision. You find yourself faced with a decision to make of whether you're going to allow yourself to be ruled by this pain or whether you're going to make this pain serve you.
And use it for something.
And use it.
I do that every day.
And use it to change. Yeah. And yes, exactly. It becomes actually a daily practice on a microcosmic level of things that happen each day. And I think one of the greatest benefits for me of going through that difficult stuff is that you become much more connected to gratitude for very small things and very simple things.
Wax, on the other hand, I thought about it, and I know it's the body, but the other thing about wax as a substance is when things get hot, it melts.
It's not permanent.
It's really kind of gooey and creepy.
It's
and
a very weird, creepy substance.
Yes, it is.
And then one of the reasons I like the word wax, I picked up a book in an airport by a British writer called Rupert Thompson, who I've since befriended because I found him on Twitter and said that his book Secrecy had really inspired me. And this book is about a 16th century wax sculptor in Florence. It's fictional. But one of the things that was going on at that time, which was true, was it was illegal to make full-size wax figures of people because people thought it was sacrilegious because they were so lifelike. It was like you were playing God by making another human because wax was so lifelike and had this glow to it. And it's about this... this kind of member of the royal family or, you know, the higher echelons of society who his wife has left him and he desperately wants a life-size figure of her to help him get over the pain. So he clandestinely commissions this man to make him a full-size model, which is highly illegal. But still, in 2018, we're still making wax models of people because they look so real. And then at the same time, we make it inside our ears.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. Thank you. Keeps Q-tips in business.
Yes.
But it's 8 years away from the moment that you really said, you know what? I'm not going to make records. I'm just going to score films. It's a much more solitary practice. But the learning is it just takes time, yeah. Right?
I had to have a reckoning with where I'd got to because... having my marriage break down and realizing I was standing in this multi-million pound rock star house in London with a rock star house in the country with a rock star car and what I thought was everything I wanted, money in the bank, and just being this dreadful cliche of going, wow, I'm totally miserable and none of this is actually making me happy. And it's not because none of this would make me happy, because now if I had a nice big house in London, a big house in the country, I'd love it. But I wasn't happy. So those things didn't matter. And it was very much a kind of Keanu Reeves waking up in slimy pod, having to unplug himself and seeing the dreary truth that there's things that you've denied, there's things that you've made up, there's things that you haven't allowed yourself to be honest with yourself about.
The sounds that you've chosen are very, not only clever, but they're you've spent a lot of time thinking about the different sounds in the different tracks, and no track, they all connect thematically, but no track connects in terms of anybody can say, oh, it's that guitar sound.
Oh no,
or it's that synth sound.
Yeah,
you know,
we shifted every time.
So tell me about that.
Well, the process of making Wax was fantastic. It's maybe my favorite record.
3 weeks, though.
3 weeks. Well, 3 weeks recording the live tracks.
And then tons of demos.
And then there was another 3 weeks after that of taking the record to a secondary duo called My Riot. So I started with Nick McCarthy, one of the founder members of Franz Ferdinand.
Mr. Franz Ferdinand, yes.
Absolutely brilliant musician, brilliant writer.
You two clicked.
We really clicked. And his partner, Seb Kellig, they're both crazy into reggae and dub. So you can hear a bit of the influence on songs like The Mountain, where there's these drones, there's a funk to it. And then
funk on a guitar record. Can you imagine?
On an indie rock guitar
record.
Can
you imagine?
Yeah, I know.
Crazy.
Really, it's a new place for me.
Crazy.
And we recorded in... Part of the reason I wanted to work with Nick was because he's got this garage in East London with a big Jamaican flag and a stuffed toy lion hanging in the corner, an upright old beaten-up piano, a bunch of amazing old synthesizers, and a bunch of amazing old guitars, and you can hardly move. And the way we recorded was myself on guitar and vocals live, Nick on bass, Denny Weston Jr., great LA drummer, on drums, no headphones. I was just listening to the desk. The guitar amp is in the toilet, the bass amp is in the drum room. We're probably no more than 7 feet away from each other. It's loud as hell, and we press record. And the thing with that, even though you're recording to computer, you're basically recording to tape, because you don't have any separation. So you have to just get the mix right and hit record and get it right. Yep. And it was extremely exciting and very quick. And so we loved recording that way. There was very little correcting going on. And we just got takes that we liked. And at the end of it, I gave the demos, or the rough mixes, not demos really, they were the recordings, to my A&R guy and my manager. And they both went, oh my God, this sounds like a three-piece garage record. And I went, yeah. And they went, no, you can't do that. And I was like, what do you mean? And they said, Kin was this big, as you said, slicker pop record. It's done great. It did great at radio. Critics loved it. You're making a trilogy. This is so far away from what you've just done, and you're going to lose momentum. And I obviously went crazy. And then I reminded myself that I should try things before I say no, because why not? So I called up one of my oldest friends, Tim Brann, who's in a duo called My Riot in London. They did Birdie, London Grammar, Churches, really great British bands.
Gorgeous stuff, yes.
Very contemporary stuff. And so actually myself and Nick and Seb, we all went over to West London from East London to Tim and Roy's studio to sit down with them and say, listen, this is what the A&R and the manager have said. Let's try it, but we need you to understand what we've done, because they're saying they don't even like the sound of the recording. And I was like, I'm sure we've got the most amazing recordings here, but it's just they're looking at a house that's a dump and they can't see it being done up. And it wasn't a dump. It's unfair to say that. It sounded great, but it was rough and it was raw. And then, so we talked about it. We talked it through. Tim and Roy, My Riot, were super respectful of what we'd done and said, no, we love the sound of what you've recorded. And we started with The River, the lead single. And within 2 hours, I was like, oh, man, this is really cool.
But it's brilliant to be willing.
Yeah, and I'm just so glad I was. And also, as an artist, it's quite hard when your manager and your A&R guy are right. You know, you don't want to give in to that.
No,
you,
especially, well, the manager, maybe, the A&R guy. No way.
Your ego is going insane in a cage.
Because then he's going to think he's...
Well, you're doing something that your record label
they're
is...
They're going to think they're right for the rest of their lives now.
Well, you know, it's fine. They were. I'm glad it happened. But, you know, I was still absolutely at the wheel in terms of the choices that were made during that process. But I was unaware of how talented my Riot were at using technical equipment, because they use it as it should be used, which is as instruments. They don't use it as, oh, this rack here sound makes this sound like that. They don't work like that. They say, we can make this do this. We've worked out how to make this do this. And they just added the most amazing texture and interest and very musical layering to what I'd done, to just give it that extra body where you could listen to it 10 times over and keep hearing something new.
But the songs, I mean, and I'm not joking about this. I'm in the shower this morning and I'm whistling the refrain from Human Being.
Oh, thank you. Well, this is my issue with the term pop, because pop means popular. Any song that is a good song, if it gets heard, is going to be popular.
See, that's
it's so funny because, you know, there's been this paradigm shift in young artists' ways of thinking that popular is great. Whereas when I was coming through, popular was danger zone because you're selling out and you're you know, it's really interesting because there's a very open ambition now, which I think was always there but was often quite veiled because it wasn't cool to be ambitious and to want to be popular. And it was never something I subscribed to, because I knew I was writing quite accessible melodies, and the themes of my music was, you know, someone wrote up Wax saying, you know, Katie Tunstall showing that the middle of the road isn't necessarily a bad place to be. And I was like, I've just spent the last 6 weeks listening on tour with the Pretenders, watching Chrissie Hynde sing Middle of the Road, That's Where You'll Find Me.
If that's
the middle of the road,
I want to be
there. That's where I am. And I love it. The middle of the road ain't no private cul-de-sac. And she said that. Yeah, so Nick and I had a week book to do pre-production. And for anyone who's not familiar with that term, it's when you get together before going into the studio to make a record, just to go through demos, listen to influences, references, try out some sounds, maybe have a look at the arrangements of songs so that you're ready when you go into the studio, because time is money. So I went to Nick's garage studio and we sat there and we didn't do any of that. We just wrote songs for 5 days.
And that's a big deal, the co-writing thing. You know, so yeah. I didn't enter that way, but that is a big deal.
It's a huge deal because there's really only one other person in my life that I write with, which is Martin Tereffa. He's a Swedish writer, and he's an old school songwriter. He's not interested in the kind of new chart pop that I don't understand either, where there isn't doesn't really
well,
a lot
send you to Nashville and you'll emerge with your next hit.
Well, the thing I don't understand is that there's a real backlash against melody at the moment, and people are not engaging with melody.
No, but there's a lot of whoa-whoas.
There's a lot of whoa-whoa-whoas. There's a lot of baby, baby, babies.
There's a lot of that.
There's a lot of And me and Martin are very old school, and we wrote Other Side of the World together. We wrote Funny Man together. We've written so many on The River. And so to sit down opposite Nick in his studio, 4 feet away from each other, less, with guitars, and suddenly be writing songs that are immediately on par with this with the stuff that I've written with Martin, I was like, oh, wait a minute, I've found another writing partner. So it's a big deal. And so he showed me, he had a couple of chord progressions on his computer that he'd banked because he liked them. And one of them was a folder that was called The Night That Bowie Died. And I said, what's that one? And he played it, and it's this beautiful chord progression. And he does the same thing that Martin and I do, where we love old-fashioned influence, but we always want to take a left turn before you're expecting, you know, it takes you somewhere you don't think you're going to go. And And he said, oh, we can call it something different. I wrote those chords, and then the next morning I came in the studio and Bowie had passed away, so that's, I just renamed the folder. And I said, no, I think it's a great name for a song, and I probably would never write a song called that if that name wasn't there, because it would maybe feel cheesy, but it's actually perfect. And we talked a lot about how when Bowie left, it just was that hive grief that kicked in, because it was almost like a tipping point where so many people are affected so deeply, even people who weren't that into him are affected by it, you know? The last time I remember feeling it was Princess Diana. When she died, it was this crazy energy globally that this person caused. And really, it's also sparking your relationship to any sort of loss. And that's what this song is about.
I've invented a thing called a musical sandwich. And what it is two of your songs on the outside, and then songs by anybody else you want to play in between. There are no rules.